If you would, take out your Bibles and in your Old Testaments, turn over to 1 Kings. We're going to be looking briefly at chapter 18 and then spend the majority of our time in chapter 19. Recently, I had someone asking me some questions about self-pity, just wrestling with feeling sorry for themselves. And the Bible speaks to that. I think what Elijah goes through over in 1 Kings chapter 19 is an excellent example of that. And I think if all of us were honest, we would say that at one time or another, we've felt that. Where things just haven't gone our way. For legitimate reasons, we're sad over something. And over time, that sadness turns into something like this. And if not caught and addressed in a godly biblical way, that self-pity can really quickly turn into anger, it can turn into bitterness, and it can affect our faith and our relationship with God. And so I think this is an important topic to consider, and I think Elijah is a great example of how this happens, and then God helping him think through about how to correct that. Let's start over in chapter 18, and what we're going to notice is a huge contrast. We know that in chapter 19, Elijah's struggling. We know that he goes over to Mount Sinai to have a conversation with God. But really, chapter 18 is a high point in the life of Elijah. We're all familiar with God's victory over the hundreds of prophets of Baal in chapter 18. What you're looking at there is a monastery on the top of Mount Carmel, commemorating the spot where this whole event took place in chapter 18. There's actually a statue, you can barely see it, of Elijah there. Now, we're just going to quickly review chapter 18. We know that for a period of time, several years, there's been a drought. That Elijah prayed to God and the heavens closed up. And there was no rain. And Elijah has been prophesying under the difficult and wicked reign of the twin tyrants, Ahab and Jezebel. One of the worst ungodly power couples of the Bible. Don't name your daughter Jezebel. Don't name your son Ahab. Just don't do it. They were wicked and idolatrous. And what we end up seeing is that after a period of time, Elijah was done wrestling with the people. He was done trying to get the people to come back to the fact that God, Jehovah, was God, and trying to get the people to come back away from idolatry. And so in verse 20 of 18, Ahab sent to all the people of Israel and gathered the prophets together at Mount Carmel. And Elijah came near to all the people and said, "How long will you go limping between two different opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him." He's saying, pick. Because they're still trying to cling to God. They're still going through the motions and the rituals of worshiping God. But they're trying to incorporate pagan idolatrous worship as well. And so what ends up happening, I mean, you remember the story. Elijah, being the gentleman that he is, gives the prophets of Baal the opportunity to try to get Baal to accept their sacrifice first. He gives them the majority of the day. And there are 450 of them compared to little old Elijah. And halfway through the day, nothing has happened yet. The sacrifice has not been accepted. And so Elijah mocks them. We remember the taunting. Maybe he's asleep. Maybe he's relieving himself. Get louder. Get louder. And so they did. They got louder and started limping around their altars. Back in verse 26, there was no voice and no one answered. So they limped around the altar they had made. A little bit of wordplay going on there. The Israelites were limping between two opinions. The prophets were limping, trying to get their God's attention. But they end up cutting themselves and drawing blood. Still, no response. Finally, Elijah gets his turn, and Elijah rebuilds the torn down altar. One altar. And he prepares the sacrifice, and he drenches the entire thing multiple times until water's just flowing down. And he offers a single short prayer. And then fire comes down from heaven, licks the whole thing up. And his point is, remember his speech at the beginning? If the Lord is God, follow him. If Baal is God, follow him. So which one had demonstrated? And it was Jehovah. And so all of the people in this very visible display of God's power and presence and divinity, Elijah turns around and says, seize those false prophets. And they put to death all of those false prophets. I mean, it's a high point. It's a high point in Elijah's ministry. And it's not done. The chapter is not complete. In verse 41 of 18, Elijah said to Ahab, go up, eat and drink, for there's a sound of the rushing of rain. They've been 3.5 years without rain. I mean, I remember last summer with the drought we had here, the further into the summer that we got, every day checking the radar. When is that rain coming? When is that rain coming? When is my water bill going to go down? And so Elijah tells Ahab, I hear water. I hear rain. So Ahab went up to eat and drink, and Elijah went up to the top of Mount Carmel, and he bowed himself down on the earth and put his face between his knees, and he said to his servant, go up now, look toward the sea. And he went up and looked and said, there's nothing. He said, go again 7 times. And at the 7th time he said, behold, a little cloud like a man's hand is rising from the sea. And he said, go up. Go up, say to Ahab, prepare your chariot and go down, lest the rain stop you. And in a little while, the heavens grew black with clouds and wind, and there was a great rain. Now, James, over in James chapter 5, quotes this moment as an example of God responding to prayer, how the prayer of a righteous man accomplishes much. After 3.5 years of drought, that Elijah prays to God, and the drought's over. He sends rain. Elijah had just witnessed God send rain after a 3.5 year drought. And he saw him do that in response to his prayer. I mean, there are times that you may pray for something for months and years before you have a response. And if that weren't enough, he had told Ahab, get in your chariot and get back to Jezreel because the rain's going to overtake you. And Ahab takes off at the end of verse 45. Ahab rode and went to Jezreel. And the hand of the Lord was on Elijah, and he gathered up his garment and ran before Ahab to the entrance of Jezreel. Now, I know some of the young boys here in the congregation, including my son, like to do this thing every worship service. And some of the dads have been having fun with them recently. They'll be out here on the side. And as one father picks up his son and the car comes past the building, the other boys will race the car with their buddy in it to see if they can beat the car to the end of the building. And when the dads are having fun, they'll goose it a little bit, and there's just no way. But I want you to think about what God enabled Elijah to do here. Ahab is in a chariot trying to beat a rainstorm. And Elijah, I'm envisioning a grizzled prophet of God who was behind, grabs his clothes and beats him on foot like it was the best foot race ever. And God got him to Jezreel ahead of Ahab. I mean, talk about a chapter with highs. God has demonstrated that he's with Elijah, that he's real, that he's powerful. All of this is being done publicly. You would think, like, that's just a great chapter. It's time to go home and take a nap. But that's not what happens. Because what chapter 19 records for us is the exact opposite of what we would expect. Now, on your left, that little triangle, about 3/4 of the way up, is Mount Carmel, over by the Mediterranean coast, on that little jut out into the Mediterranean. That's Mount Carmel. And Elijah and Ahab had raced, just if you come down to about 5 o'clock, they had come down to Jezreel. That's where they had raced. But in verse 1 of 19, Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. Then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah saying, so may the gods do to me and more also if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by this time tomorrow. And then he was afraid, and he arose and ran for his life and came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and left his servant there. And so we're just going to summarize his movement. I mean, this is what goes on. Elijah heard that Jezebel wanted to kill him. And so he traveled about 100 miles south to Beersheba, down in this purple area here, down by the Negev. It's about 100 miles from Jezreel to Beersheba. He travels that in 3 weeks. It should only have taken him a little over one. He is slowly trying to escape Jezebel. And then when he gets to Beersheba, he travels alone. He has this servant that's been with him. In verse 3, it says he was afraid. He arose, ran for his life, came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and he left his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a broom tree. He goes off by himself. You start to see the self-pity thing kick in here. Because when you start to experience self-pity, even if it's a result of something genuinely sad, you tend to isolate yourself. I just want to be alone. But then what he does next, he asked that he might die, saying, "It's enough. Now, O Lord, take my life, for I'm no better than my father's." This is the guy that just last chapter experienced this incredible victory over hundreds of prophets of Baal. Saw God in a very public, dramatic way respond to a prayer. Experienced divine power to outrun a chariot. But now he's hiding under a tree by himself in the wilderness, and he wants to die. And that's not all. After resting and eating, he took 40 days to travel from there to go on down to Mount Sinai. It should only have taken him 2 weeks, but he took over a month. He meanders his way down to Sinai. And when he gets there, he comes to a cave in verse 9. He comes to a cave and lodged in it. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said to him, "What are you doing here? What are you doing here, Elijah?" And then he answers. Now we're going to talk about his answer. But what just happened? Someone summarized this by saying Elijah retreated before a beaten enemy. God had just demonstrated that Baal was not real. God had just publicly demonstrated that their false god was a false god. That he had beaten Ahab. And Elijah ran away before a defeated enemy. Someone said, "Beware of human reactions after holy exertions." That's true. Have you all ever experienced that? Where after an incredibly powerful moment in your life spiritually, it was a great thing, something amazing happened. Maybe it was a response to a prayer. Maybe it was conversion. Whatever it was, maybe it was a new principle or maybe a new habit that you had put on. And right after that, you have a very human moment. I've had those. And that's what we see Elijah experiencing here. A very human moment. A friend of mine posted that and I loved it. That's what Elijah's experiencing. He expected his life to just be this uphill growth chart, you know, straight up. And that's not how life went for him. Although I'd wager to say life didn't go that way for any of the prophets. Their life is like that squiggly line. I mean, going backwards and down and then back. That's the way our lives go. There are detours that we didn't expect, curveballs that we didn't see coming. There are hard things. Everybody experiences that. One of my friends shared that this week and said, "This is my week." And I said, "I'm using that on Sunday." You know, Elijah is not alone. There are other biblical writers that have spoken about the experience of self-pity. Asaph, over in Psalm 73, said this. A psalmist said this. "As for me, my feet had almost stumbled. My steps had nearly slipped, for I was envious of the arrogant when I saw the prosperity of the wicked." You have somebody who's trying to live a godly life, somebody who's trying to follow Jehovah, and he's comparing the difficulties of his life with the prosperity of the wicked man who doesn't give a hoot about God. He says, it's not fair. And he said, when I thought how to understand this, when I tried to wrap my mind around it, it seemed to me a wearisome task. My soul was embittered when I was pricked in the heart. I was brutish and ignorant. I was like a beast toward you. He says, inside, I was bitter. Because he's comparing his life with somebody else's life. And it just didn't seem fair. Elijah's not the only one. This is kind of what I'm assuming. And it's kind of what the text leads you to assume. What the text leads you to assume is that Elijah thought at the end of chapter 18 that when he got to Jezreel, the hometown of Ahab and Jezebel, that God was going to take care of them right on the spot. And God didn't. And that's not what Elijah wanted to happen. And so he was trying to wrap his mind around what he thought should happen with what actually happened. Someone said this in describing self-pity. This describes Elijah. Self-pity is always counterproductive. It consists of a concentration upon self and one's supposed rights and usually involves a protest against God's providence. Do you know any other prophets that kind of fit that category? Maybe this guy named Jonah who didn't want to go to Nineveh. And he went and preached the shortest sermon ever, not because he was trying to be popular, but because he didn't want to preach. And basically said, repent, and walked off stage. And lo and behold, they did. And he didn't like it. And then he went and sat outside the city and was like, why did they listen? I can't believe they listened. This isn't fair. And so God creates some shade for him and then takes the shade away. And he's throwing a hissy fit that he lost his shade. And God says, do you do well to be angry? And he says, yes! No, he didn't. He was more worried about the perspiration on his forehead than the souls in that city. So let's look at 1 Kings 19 and see what we can learn from Elijah. What was going on with him? He told us. Because he had this great conversation where he was honest with God. We're going to compare Elijah's conversation here in 1 Kings 19 with what Asaph ends up figuring out in Psalm 73. But let's look at 1 Kings 19 first. When you go back to the text, the first thing that he said when he's in the wilderness near Beersheba, he says, it's enough. Now, O Lord, take my life, for I'm no better than my father's. So God gives him provision, sends him down to Sinai. He shows up in Sinai, goes into the cave, and when God asks, what are you doing here? He says in verse 10 and in verse 14, he repeats himself. He says, I have been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts. For the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, killed your prophets with the sword. And I, even I only am left, and they seek my life to take it away. And the God says, just a minute, I'm going to show up. And we'll read about that in just a second. But then when God shows up, there's a voice that says, what are you doing here, Elijah, in verse 13? And he says the same thing again. So looking at his statements, what can we pick up? He does not have hope. Self-pity does not fix anything. That's one of the natures of self-pity. I kind of sit and I brood and I stew, but it robs me of doing anything. It doesn't energize me. It's just perpetual mourning over something. And so we're going to notice something in his language, and we'll probably see ourselves in this. What's the first thing that we see? The self-destructive language of defeat. He mentions it first back in verse 4. It's enough. It's enough. There's no hope. I'm done. Take away my life. There's no more benefit. There's nothing left for me to do. And think about that. He had just seen the prophets of Baal defeated. He had just seen the answered prayer. He had just outrun a chariot. And he's sitting there going, I am tired and I am done. when we get into this mode of self-pity, that's us. We don't see any hope. We don't see any light at the end of the tunnel. Have you ever said anything like that? I'm done. I'm just done. Now, there's something that we need to balance in all of this. Is it okay to go to God when you're hurting? Yes. Is God compassionate? Yes. Does God want to hear this? Yes. But we're talking about someone who is staying in this spot. I don't think it's accidental that he's in a cave. That's kind of how we feel. We're going to say more about balancing out God's compassion, but where he is not in a good place. He says it's enough. He's defeated. We also see the language of pride. He mentions it both in verse 10 and in verse 14. And you just got to kind of read this in there. I have been so zealous. I mean, when it comes to being an Israelite and a prophet, like my brothers have this saying, like, I'm the bomb.com. I'm the best. I am so zealous. And the reason that I'm emphasizing that is because right after that, he compares himself to everybody else. I am so zealous and no one else is. He's not being honest. He's being prideful. I am such a good follower of you, God. You know what ends up happening when we're in a mode of self-pity? Is we tend to exaggerate or inflate our opinion of ourselves. My skills are the best. No one else can do this like me. That's what happens. I'm invaluable. We start to use the language of pride, and Elijah's no exception. And it's quickly followed with complaint. I am so great, but... And so what he does in verses 10 and 14, these people, you know how bad these people are? Let me tell you, the people have forsaken your covenant. They've thrown down your altars. They've killed your prophets with the sword. Now, wait a minute. If you go back to the last chapter, what did God's people actually just do? God's people actually just took their lives in their own hands by killing the king and queen's prophets. It wasn't Elijah by himself running around killing all those wicked people. He may have started by rebuilding that altar, but his influence influenced everybody. There were other people along with him that day, and he doesn't mention any of that. Is there some truth to the complaint? Yes. But this is the other part of self-pity. I start to inflate my importance, and I start to exaggerate how bad things are. I make it seem like my problem is unlike anybody else's. Did you catch it in 10 and 14? And I only, all by my little self, all here in this cave with just me, am left. No one else is going what I'm going through. Have you ever said something like that? No one could possibly understand. You know, and when we say that, really, this is what we're saying, whether we intend to or not. Out of every single individual that has ever lived in the thousands of years of existence, all of them, the billions of people that have lived, I am the only one in creation that has ever experienced anything remotely like. Really? That's what we say. If you only knew what this was like. Now, are there times where someone is not able to empathize with you as much because they have not experienced exactly what you did? Yes, there's some truth to that. But guess what? So have they. I mean, what an arrogant thing to think that maybe they have experienced something that you haven't. Does that negate what you've experienced? No. But it doesn't elevate yours over theirs. I'll tell you what. There was a trip that I took by plane sometime in 2013. I can't remember exactly where I was going at the time, but it was after we first lost Whitaker, and we were going through the airport, and one of my habits, this is just something fun I like to do, I'll pop into an airport bookstore and see what's on the bestseller list. What's trending, what's out there that I think would be appropriate for me to get. And it's hardly ever the fictional stuff. When I pop into the airport, I'm usually looking for autobiographies or something like that. And there was a book that just had a cool cover. The cover and the title grabbed me. And I was rushing, and so I grabbed it. And it had to do with a ghost map. I'm like, ooh, kind of spooky. This is going to be great. And so I grabbed this book on the ghost map and started reading it. And that was such a good thing for me to read. You know why? Because it had to do with medical science and figuring out how viruses were being passed along, bacteria were being passed along through contaminated drinking water in London that they hadn't figured out how it was getting transmitted. They had all these wacky ideas about how and why people were getting sick. And this entire neighborhood was the test case where they finally figured out there was this ghost map where these people had died. And by retracing routes, they traced it back to this one source of water in the entire neighborhood. The ghost map pointed to the water. And they ended up figuring out that's where the contamination was coming from. Now you're like, that sounds like a really depressing book. It was. That was a really depressing book. Amazing. But you know why it was so helpful for me at that point? I had lost a child. Entire families were gone in a week. Boom. Is it hard to lose a child? Yes. Is it painful? Yes. Is it okay to mourn? Yes. Is it all right to be sad? Yes. Is it the worst thing ever? No. It is not. Are there people that have experienced worse? Yes. Did I need to get over myself? Yes. I did. I was not the only one, and mine was not the worst. It was helpful. God used that really depressing book to help me with that. Now, let's talk about one more. The language of tragic exaggeration. Did you catch when he was describing the people, when he says, I only am left, and they seek to take my life, to take it away? No, they didn't. No, they didn't. Go back to the beginning of the chapter, and it's Jezebel. Jezebel says, I'm going to get you. Not the nation, not all of those people. Those other people had taken their life in their own hands. He exaggerated how big the problem was. And we do that when we're experiencing self-pity. Now, what did Asaph do? What did God need to do for both Asaph and Elijah to help them figure out to address their self-pity? In Psalm 73, 16 and 17, Asaph says, when I thought how to understand this, the unfairness of the righteous and the wicked in their lives, it seemed to me a wearisome task until I went to the sanctuary of God. Then I discerned their end. This is what happens with self-pity. With self-pity, I'm looking in and I'm looking down at what this problem is. And I see myself as more important and the problem is much bigger than what it really is. And that's what Asaph was doing. He was looking at himself like, I don't deserve this. And looking at other people, and they're getting what I do deserve. And what he says about himself is that his perspective changed when he went to see God. He's like, I have not been thinking about God. I need to focus on God. And I need to think about more than just right here and right now. I need to think about a bigger picture than that. God does the same thing for Elijah. Let's go back to 1 Kings 19. And let's read some of what we've skipped over in verses 11 through 13. He said, go out and stand on the mount before the Lord. And behold, the Lord passed by, and a great and strong wind tore the mountains and broke in pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, the sound of a low whisper. And when Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his cloak and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. And behold, there came a voice to him and said to him, what are you doing here, Elijah? What is going on? God shows up. Elijah's looking at himself, and he's looking at Jezebel, and he's looking at his circumstances, and everything is out of proportion. Everything is out of whack. He's looking at so many things wrong. And so God gets his attention and shows up in a dramatic way. And I want you to think about this. He shows up in a way reminiscent of the time he came to Mount Sinai with the Israelites. Things shake, loud noises, fire, That's kind of what Elijah was waiting for back in Jezreel. God, show up and take care of Ahab and Jezebel. But he doesn't interact with Elijah until all that settles down. And it's just God's small voice. And God helps Elijah both in how he responded and then in what he had to say. In verses 15 on down, we'll walk through this as we answer the question. God draws our focus off of ourselves and back to him in truth. Okay, self-pity, my focus is off. And so to address that, God needs to get our focus off of us and back on him. That's what Asaph said. Until I went to the sanctuary. What does he say? He tries to get his focus on our victorious God and restores hope. He restores hope. He experiences a theophany, God showing up, and reminds him of when he showed up in the past. I need to remember that. God's victories don't always look like what I expect them to look like. But God shows up when he's ready to show up, and it's time to show up. God is victorious. I need to remember that. I need to not get so focused on the here and now and forget that God is victorious overall. There's this passage over in 2 Corinthians 4:17. We're going to look at it kind of backwards. But what Paul told the Corinthian church is this light momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison. The last half of that phrase says that God's preparing for us an eternal weight of glory. There's hope. Even when we're going through something difficult, it's okay. Because put in the perspective of eternity, there's something so much better than what we're experiencing right now. Focusing on our victorious God restores hope. And the way God showed up, he reminded Elijah that God was God, Elijah was not. God was holy. And he is still holy. Focusing on our holy God provides perspective on ourselves. God is God. I am not. God is not going to do things the way that I think he needs to do things. He's not going to do things in the time that I think he needs to do it. Elijah had actually been a little presumptuous in assuming how God would take care of Ahab and Jezebel. God had to remind him that he was God. And you know, focusing on God actually gets us to focus on others as well. If I love a holy God with everything that I should love him with, then I'll also love others. Self-pity, I'm not thinking about others. I'm thinking about me. I'm in this cave by myself like Elijah was. But when I get my perspective back on God, a holy God that's put me here to serve others, all of a sudden I'm not as focused on me, I'm also focused on other people. That's exactly what Jesus was teaching over in Luke 10. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and prophets. You know, there's this image where the kids go riding out of the Red Barn on 119, and they've got this trail. It's really not much of a trail, but it winds through the trees on their property. There's this little path. And along the path, they have these red boards that look like they got old barn boards. And they got red boards with white paint to put inspirational sayings on there for the kids that are riding through the trails. And I was following the kids and got kind of behind because I thought, those are cool boards. So I'm taking pictures of the boards. But there's one that I just love. It's actually the locked screen of my iPad. It's a quote from Booker T. Washington. If you want to lift yourself up, lift up someone else. That's what Jesus was talking about. Not in a manipulative way, not that you're trying to use other people to help you, but really it's good for you. It's good for you when you love God first and serve others. That's the opposite of self-pity. And maybe this is a good place to talk about trying to balance out. Is this self-pity or is this just appropriate for me to be sad for a while? If your sadness is keeping you from doing what you need to do, if your sadness is interfering with your responsibilities, if it's keeping you from ways of serving, then it's probably turned into self-pity. If you're being sad and it's a moment of sadness, but you're still able to go and be what God calls you to be, then it's okay. Take a few minutes and experience the sadness and then go and live. But if your sadness is taking over your life, if your focus on your problem is taking over your life, then something is off. Okay? Let's go back to the other three. Focusing on our good God reminds us of grace and mercy. All through chapter 19, do you realize how gracious God was? I mean, how would you feel as an employer if one of your employees had a really rough year, maybe a really rough quarter, and they just came up and they're like, I'm done. Like, finito. I am out of here. I am so done. All the other employees, slackers. They make my job so hard. Not even a 2 weeks notice. If you were the employer, you might get a little irked at that. You'd have the right to go, wait a minute, slow down. We haven't had any conversations yet. What's going on? How do you think God had the right to feel when Elijah shows up and he's like, take me now. I'm just going to lay down under this broom tree. I'm done. God's like, no, you're not. But you know what God did instead? Is he fed him. He fed him. He told him to rest. And then he gave him two meals and then said, come meet me over in Sinai. And then when he shows up to meet him, he doesn't go, what is your problem, Elijah? What's your deal? That's not what he says. He shows up and he says, what's going on? What's going on? And then he gives him the chance to explain. God demonstrates graciousness and mercy through all of that. Focusing on God's grace and mercy helps us be gracious and merciful. Jesus explained over in Luke chapter 17 and verse 10 that at the end of the day, after I've done what God has asked me to do, it's not because I'm some superstar Christian. My attitude about myself is I'm just a servant and I've done what was my duty to do. Focusing on our good God reminds us of grace and mercy. And I love what God has to say. The second time after he gives his response, the Lord in verse 15, he gives them jobs. He tells them to get out of the cave. He says, leave the cave, appoint this guy king, appoint this guy king, appoint this guy your successor. I want you to mentor him. And oh yeah, by the way, in verse 18, I will leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal and every mouth that has not kissed him. You thought you were alone. There are 7,000 people. 7,000. In the northern kingdom. That have not bowed to Baal. Now, let's put that in perspective. Weeks ago, we mentioned the population of Bethlehem. The population of Bethlehem in the first century was 700. He's saying there are 7,000 people that have not bowed down to Baal. Focusing on our omniscient God reveals that we are not alone. We're not alone. 1 Corinthians 10:13, Paul says, no temptation has overtaken you that is not common. That is not common to man. So when I make a statement like, well, no one can understand, that's a lie that you have believed from Satan. There are people on this earth that have gone through what you have gone through. There are. You are not alone. That's kind of sad because we live in a broken world, but God means it to be comforting. You're not alone. There are people out there that can relate and that can empathize and that can encourage. God helps him with that. Focusing on our sovereign God puts our trials in perspective. This is where we go back. This is where we go back to 2 Corinthians 4:7. And let's turn over there. 2 Corinthians 4:7. Explains that as apostles, ministers of the gospel of Jesus, he compares their bodies to clay jars, these fragile earthenware vessels. And he says that those are our bodies. But inside of those earthenware vessels, we have something very precious. We have the gospel of God. And what we go through as apostles, we feel hurt. We feel hurt. He says in verse 8, we're afflicted in every way, but we're not crushed. We're confused. We're perplexed, but not driven to despair. We're persecuted but not forsaken, struck down but not destroyed. Does that kind of sound like Elijah? He's feeling all of that pressure, always carrying in the body the death of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may also be manifested in our bodies. You come down to verse 16. So we do not lose heart. Though our outer self is wasting away, our inner self is being renewed day by day. For this light, momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison. Now, we made the point back on point one that focusing on God, our victorious God, he's preparing for us an eternal weight of glory. We have hope. But he also acknowledges that there are difficult things. Like when we had that graph and my life goes like this, it does. But there's a three-part comparison that Paul makes here in that verse, in verse 17. Focusing on our sovereign God puts our trials in perspective. With self-pity, the trial gets so big, it's overwhelming. But what he says is, it's light. It's momentary. It is affliction. And he's able to say that because he contrasts that with the eternal weight of glory that's being prepared for us. Compared to the victory that we have in Jesus, what we're going through is light. It doesn't mean it's not heavy, but it's light by comparison, in comparison to the weight of the glory. And what we're going through and what Elijah was going through and what Asaph was going through was momentary compared to the eternity, the eternal nature of the glory that we have in Jesus. And he's honest when he says it's hard. He calls it an affliction. It is. It's hard. But that's okay. Because the affliction is temporary and light. Because the glory that we're about to receive through Jesus is eternal and weighty. Focusing on God puts our trials in perspective. It shrinks them back down. Let's just put this in perspective. If you were to look at those two charts of your life, maybe your week, maybe your day, maybe your weekend, maybe your month, does that squiggly backwards, upside down one kind of, is that where you see yourself right now? All of us hit that. All of us hit that. Some of us hit it multiple times. It's a part of life. We get some uphill growth, happy. We get those. God blesses us with those. But we all hit those curveballs. We all get those. And there are times that even believers like Asaph and like Elijah have these moments where they retreat before a defeated enemy. We just do. We get tired. And we have questions. That's okay. But if you realize that you've been allowing your disappointment or your confusion, or your hurt, if you've been allowing those things to keep you from being who God wants you to be and fulfilling the responsibilities and the privileges and the opportunities he's given you, it's possible that like Elijah in 1 Kings 19, you found yourself in this cave of self-pity. And as we repeated some of the things that he said, you might have heard yourself in that. Because we all do. If that's where you've found yourself, I hope this last slide is helpful. God's desire is for you to get your focus back on him. It's okay to express hurt. It's okay to express frustration. He's a compassionate God, and he's gracious and merciful. If you're not yet a Christian, the hope of glory that we're talking about in 2 Corinthians 4, that is a hope that's reserved for those who have placed their faith in Jesus. They've been baptized into Christ's body. They're able to confidently approach the throne of God, according to Hebrews 4. If you're not a Christian who can do those things yet, we'd like to let you know you can become a Christian. You can place your faith in Christ. You can die with him. You can be raised with him. You can be in God's presence right now. But if you're a Christian and you're struggling with those things, let us help you get your focus back on God. Whatever your need is, please respond to 1 Kings 19 as we turn and sing.